and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. In a moment, we're going to talk about the origins of the Second Amendment with one of the nation's leading scholars on the Second Amendment here on Radioactivity. There's an effort to put an assault weapons ban on the 2020 Florida ballot. A group called Ban Assault Weapons Now is beginning a petition drive. It's headed by Gail Schwartz, who lost her nephew in the Parkland massacre. The proposed amendment would prohibit all semi-automatic rifles and shotguns capable of holding more than 10 rounds. If the amendment passes, those who already own assault weapons in Florida could keep the guns they already own, but they would have to register their firearms with the state within a year of the amendment's effective date. The group has already collected more than $400,000 from about 1,900 people. That's an average donation of about $145. Following the Parkland shooting, Democratic lawmakers tried to force a debate on banning assault weapons in the legislature in Tallahassee. They ultimately failed. Assault weapons are military-style weapons built to fire one shot at a time, but they can be easily modified to shoot rapid fire. Our guest today in this first half hour is Saul Cornell, a leading authority on early American constitutional thought and on the Second Amendment. He'll be giving a talk this Friday night at 8 p.m. at the University of Tampa entitled The Second Amendment, Myths and Realities. It begins at 8 p.m. More on that later. And Saul Cornell, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I want to ask you about the Second Amendment. I'm going to read it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Oftentimes, when I'm driving around and I see somebody in a truck with a Second Amendment bumper sticker, I see the second half of that amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, but I don't see the first half of that. What did the founders mean by that amendment?
Well, I think your point about bumper stickers is actually very relevant because one of the problems we have is that our debate over both the Second Amendment and gun policy tends to take the form of sound bites and bumper stickers and slogans, and you know, I have to admit that the gun rights side of the debate has much better bumper stickers than the people favoring gun regulation, because it is hard to try and summarize this piece of American constitutional history and fit it on a bumper sticker. I mean, a lot of people, when they read the Second Amendment, think, oh, it's so odd. They, you know, how come the founders didn't make things clearer? But of course, that's if you read it with a sort of 21st century set of assumptions. If you put yourself into the mind of someone in the 18th century, actually the Second Amendment is pretty crystal clear. It uses a very common Latin construction called the ablative absolute, and that pretty much means that if we were to sort of render it, it would be because a well-regulated militia is necessary to security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So now the question becomes, well, if a well-regulated militia, is necessary, then what does that mean about gun policy and what does that mean about gun regulation? And that's where things sort of get more complicated. There's no question that Americans in the contemporary public debate, I don't know actually if it's true of most Americans. In fact, I think it's probably not true. But in the public debate, it seems to be the choice is only more guns or more regulation. But I think the founders' choice was to have a well-armed society, but a well-regulated society. And that's the position that seems to have dropped out in our public debate. Although, frankly, when I talk to people and when I give talks like the one I'm giving at Tampa, that actually is the position I think that not only makes the most sense for society that has a lot of guns, but it's also the position I think most Americans intuitively recognize is the only way you can have a society in which there are a lot of guns. You have to have a very effective and strong regulatory regime to make sure that people who shouldn't have guns don't get them.
Why did the founders want a well-regulated militia? What were they calling for there?
Well, it's important to recognize that America was probably a much better armed society than the world that the founders left in England. England was a society where the policy was largely aimed at making sure that guns were not in the hands of peasants, but America was a society in many respects in which those peasants were at the forefront of moving to the New World. And of course, they were moving into a situation where you had the French in Canada, you had the Spanish in your part of the world, and of course, you had native populations who were not too keen on their new neighbors, who seemed to be very interested in expanding and not as interested in establishing good diplomatic relations with the indigenous population. So having a militia was absolutely essential. I mean, you're living on the edge of the British Empire, and there are no police forces. You don't have much of a British military presence. So if you don't get your population organized and get them armed, you're not in a very safe position in the 17th century and much of the 18th century.
Did they believe, did the founders think that the nation or the state should have standing armies?
Well, this, of course, another thing that's so hard for us to get our head around. We have the biggest standing army in the history of the world. In fact, you know, we spend more in the military, I think, than maybe the next 20 nations combined. We have become very comfortable with a professional military force, and that's what a standing army is. Now, for much of American history, leading up to the Revolution, Americans are very uncomfortable with a standing army. They see them as redcoats, as those British regulars who shot Americans, Bostonians, in the streets of Boston. Now, of course, what happens during the Revolution is this veneration of the militia, the belief that, you know, a free society can only survive if you don't have the standing army and you rely on a militia, well, that's put to the test, because the militia does some things very well, but it does not do other things very well. And I think the leading military minds responsible for our independence, people like Washington, Hamilton, General Knox and others, realize that if we're going to defeat the most powerful nation on earth, we need to have a European-style standing army that can be fielded and can take on that standing British army. And so you get this disconnect between sort of the rhetoric, which is always about the militia, but the reality, which is the militia is good for some things, but it's just not going to do everything we need it to do.
If the militia was there to defend against the Indians or the Spanish or the English, did all the colonists back in the day, back in the 1700s, did they all have the same kind of gun that would operate the same way?
Well, again, you know, this is another fascinating thing. We you know, there's been a lot of controversy, although we now, because of controversy over how well-armed Americans were in this period, we have actually a pretty good idea at the moment. And so you get this fascinating reality, which again is so different than the current debate, because basically most Americans wanted the kind of guns you need around this time of year to put turkey on the table. You know, they wanted to kill critters eating the crops, and they wanted to shoot birds to put on the table. And so they wanted either something like a shotgun or in the 18th century, a fowling piece, you know, a gun that shot, you know, little pellets to kill birds, or they wanted a fairly light kind of musket that would be easy to carry around. And of course, those weapons were not the kind you needed if you wanted to fight the British and you wanted to have a standing army, because basically, once you get that first shot off with your musket, if you don't have a bayonet attached to that musket, you're looking down the barrel of a British regular. And so, ironically, the big problem at the time of the Second Amendment was that Americans liked guns and had many guns, but they didn't want the kind of guns that were good for national defense. So the government, both the states and the federal government, had to force them. And so what we forget is that originally the right to bear arms was as much an obligation. I mean, the government, either the state governments or the federal government, couldn't force you to practice your religion. They couldn't force you to publish. They couldn't force you to assemble. But they could force you to bear arms, unless you were a Quaker or a Mennonite, someone who was religiously scrupulous about bearing arms. And so, ironically, forcing people to buy their own guns at their own expense is like the first unfunded federal mandate. It's a burden. It's a form of taxation. And, you know, basically, I think if most people realize that, they would not be screaming about the Second Amendment with quite the same volume, because they'd basically be asking for additional taxes.
Now, were all males supposed to be in the militia?
Well, the way the statutes are written is the vast majority of white men were supposed to be in the militia, but there were obviously exclusions based on age. So, you know, boys weren't in the militia until they reached the age of about 16, and men over a certain age weren't. And of course, one of my favorite exclusions is in Massachusetts, for instance, they exempted the faculty of Harvard College, because I think everyone in America could agree that arming the Harvard faculty was not a good idea then, probably not a good idea now.
Well, so by well-regulated, these people who had to be called up in the event of an attack from the British or, a fight with the Indians, they had to be called up. They had to have a rifle that would work to kill other people. So that was the regulation that was required in the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I mean, again, I like to point out to people, and it comes as quite a surprise, that if we actually restored the original Second Amendment, it would be a nightmare both for the most ardent gun rights people and for the most ardent gun control people, because it would probably mean that everyone would have a gun in their gun safe stored in their basement, but we'd all have to drop what we're doing at a minute's notice, like the Minutemen, and report to muster. And, George Washington actually wanted to see mandatory inspections twice a year of firearms. So to actually have that well-regulated militia, we would have actually more government intrusion in our lives, not less.
We're talking about the Second Amendment with Saul Cornell. He's the Paul and Diane Gunther Chair in American History at Fordham University. He's the author of The Other Founders, Anti-Federalism and the Dissenting Tradition in America, and also A Well-Regulated Militia, the Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America. And this is WMNF in Tampa. If you've got a comment, you can email it into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. So the idea of arms back then, did they envision things like semi-automatic weapons? Did people back then were they allowed to have cannon, for instance?
Well, again, the major reality that America had to deal with in the 18th century was that guns were difficult to maintain. Pistols were virtually useless unless you were a gentleman engaging in a duel. And so policy, the great danger of disarmament in the 18th century that you sometimes see reference to was that government would not arm the people, not that government would take people's guns away. And, of course, what changes with the market revolution and the democratization that occurs in the 19th century is, for the first time, you get reliable, cheap, easily concealable handguns. And that's when you get the real makings of our modern debate about gun rights versus gun control. In the 18th century, the debate is really very different. It's about, can you have a society dependent on the militia? And if we're going to have a new federal government, how do we protect the militia enough so that this powerful federal government won't threaten our liberty? And, for someone like Thomas Jefferson, the idea that states might use their militias as the ultimate check on the federal government was a very plausible interpretation of what the Constitution had done. Of course, with the exception of people who haven't realized that the South lost the Civil War, that option was basically taken off the table as a result of the Civil War, because it was the South Carolina militia that fired on Fort Sumter. And as a result of the Civil War, we no longer believe that state militias have that power.
All right, so I want to get to that a little bit more deeply. Some people say the Second Amendment is there as a check on the federal government to make sure that it doesn't get too powerful, and at an appropriate time, a violent revolution might be possible. And that's why the Second Amendment, or a violent revolution might be needed, and that's why the Second Amendment is there.
Well, again, as I said, that there is a reading of the Second Amendment that made a certain amount of sense before the Civil War, if you were Jeffersonian. I mean, obviously, the Federalists didn't buy that amendment, that interpretation of the amendment. They were actually much more concerned about strengthening the federal government, not weakening it. But, it was never understood to be an individual right to take up guns against the government, because that would lead to anarchy. And, of course, what we forget is that the people who gave us the Second Amendment, including James Madison, were exactly the people who were most worried about either both slave uprisings in the South and angry farmers in the North, like the rebels who took up arms in Shays' Rebellion. And when people decided to take up arms against Hamilton's economic policies, I guess they weren't singing about it the way they do today, it was the militia they sent in to crush the rebellion. So, and then, of course, there's the ultimate argument against this what's often called the insurrectionary theory of the Second Amendment, is the only crime that's actually defined in the Constitution is taking up arms against the government. So unless you believe that somehow the Second Amendment repealed the treason clause with nobody realizing it at the time, it doesn't make a lot of sense to think that the founders were these Maoist revolutionaries who wanted to have everyone armed so they could, you know, in some Red Dawn fantasy, take up arms against the government. They were Whig revolutionaries, not Maoists.
Our guest is Saul Cornell. He'll be speaking this Friday night at 8 o'clock at the University of Tampa. He'll be speaking in the trustees' boardroom on the 9th floor of the Vaughn Center. That's free and open to the public. That begins at 8 p.m. Here's a question from John in Port Richey. He said, thanks for the show. I'd like to know the link between Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16 with the Second Amendment and what it means on its own. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16 says, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part of them as may be employed in service of the U.S., reserving to the states respectively in the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress.
Well, that's quite a mouthful there, isn't
it? It is for me, yeah.
So basically, here's what happens is the anti-federalists, who are the original opponents of the Constitution, of course, I got into the Second Amendment not so much because of modern gun policy, but because I was very interested in what happened to anti-federalist ideas and the arguments about the standing armies and militias were part of that. So the anti-federalists are very worried about the power of this new federal government, and one of the things they see, and really the two things that they see as most ominous, are its power to tax and its power to use military force to compel obedience. And so there are a lot of people who want to see states retain control of their militia, but that would have made it very difficult to actually enforce federal law. So there's this compromise that's struck where basically the federal government gets the primary control over the militia, but there's a sop to the anti-federalists to say, but you can appoint the officers, on the theory that if you appoint the officers, you will retain some control. They will not become puppets of this distant government. Well, for most people who read the Constitution, once it's actually published in the newspapers, this is not satisfactory, and they want both greater control returned to the states, and they want an express protection for the right to keep and bear arms, because that's the foundation of the militia. And essentially, anti-federalists are basically frustrated, and they think the Second Amendment is almost worse than no amendment at all, because it states this principle that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and it ties it to the necessity of having a well-regulated militia, but it doesn't do anything to make sure that's going to happen. So the general consensus among the anti-federalists is the Second Amendment is a waste of verbiage. It states something that everyone believes in, but doesn't do anything to make sure that it's going to happen. And so what's funny is the veneration that so many people have to the Second Amendment today is kind of ironic, given the fact that at the time, most people didn't think it was worth very much. In some ways, neither Madison nor the Anti-Federalists would have ranked it near the top of the most important amendments. For one thing, it wasn't even really the Second Amendment. It only became the Second Amendment when the first two amendments weren't adopted. So, you still hear people say, they made it second because it's the second most important, but that's just silly because it was actually the Fourth Amendment. And if that logic is true, you got to explain to me how the Third Amendment is so important, because I don't think any American can actually tell you what the Third Amendment says.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up right now.
Yeah, it's quartering of troops, but, and I like to say it's the most successful amendment because we've never really had a issue with it since we adopted it.
We don't really violate that. Our guest is Saul Cornell, who's a leading authority on early American constitutional thought, and he'll be speaking at the University of Tampa this Friday night. Bill in St. Pete writes this, regarding Antonin Scalia, the late Supreme Court Justice's argument for originalism. He says, the Constitution that I interpret and apply is not living but dead, or as I prefer to call it, enduring. It means today not what a current society, much less courts, think it ought to mean, but what it meant when it was adopted. That's the quote from Scalia.
Yeah.
Bill says this. He said, by that measure, the Second Amendment means every citizen is entitled to a muzzle-loading single-shot musket. That's Bill's question.
Yes. Well, you hear that one a lot, too. So there's a couple of things to say about that. First is you wouldn't apply that to the logic to the First Amendment, right? I mean, wouldn't say that you get to have your hand crank printing press, but the internet has no First Amendment protection, or cable news has no First Amendment protection. So we generally don't make those kind of technological arguments about other amendments. But the bigger problem is that Scalia, you know, his whole theory depends on history, and he was just a dreadful historian. I mean, his decision in Heller, which is bloviated and, you know, convoluted, I mean, it just hasn't stood up to scrutiny. Most of the, and many of the historical arguments he makes are just outright false, if not bordering on fantasy. So, you know, this is a general problem with originalism, is that you find very few serious historians who are originalists, because they all know that doing history is hard and complicated, and particularly at the time the Constitution was adopted, you're talking about a moment in American history where even Hamilton and Madison couldn't agree on interpreting the Constitution, and they had both, you know, ardently supported it, and within like a year of it being adopted, they're on opposite sides of virtually every issue. So I think we invoke the founders as if there was this group that actually believed the same thing, but the reality is Americans were deeply divided in 1788. And if you're an originalist and you did it well, which most originalists don't do because they just don't know the history very well, the best you could probably come up with is saying, well, I don't know, am I a Hamiltonian or am I a Jeffersonian? You know, I mean, which is the right way to interpret the Constitution? Who got it right? So, you know, I'm very, very suspicious of people who put a lot of faith in originalism, because I don't think its track record is very good.
All right, so you mentioned the Heller decision. Scalia was still alive for that decision. Am I right? Heller basically threw out a Washington, D.C. gun law and, in essence, expanded people's access to guns through Heller. How would you describe what Heller resulted in?
Well, Heller is this remarkable decision because it reverses 70 years of pretty well-established precedent. And when you read the decision, you know, it's got a lot of history in it, but when it comes down to the key intellectual moves, Scalia says things like, well, handguns are protected, which of course is just silly, because handguns were the least important guns to the purpose of the Second Amendment at the time that it was proposed. He says that most Americans, you know, prefer handguns for self-defense, therefore it must be, you know, what the Second Amendment protects. But that's not a constitutional originalist argument. That's a living Constitution on steroids argument. So, you know, when you peel away the logic of Scalia's opinion, it's just completely a con job, and it's just intellectually embarrassing when you actually go and you check his footnotes. Like, he says that the preamble, you know, the original part of the first part of the amendment that talks about a well-regulated militia, he says, well, you just put that aside and you read the second part first. And then once you decide what the second part means, you go and read the first part. Well, that's just like the bumper sticker you mentioned at the beginning. We don't read the Constitution like a bumper sticker.
Yeah, you figure that an originalist would take the whole amendment and not try to chop it in half and say, well, you've got to exclude this part. Our guest is Saul Cornell. He's the author of a book called A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America. He'll be speaking at the University of Tampa this Friday night. I want to bring it up to date a little bit. I mentioned at the top of the show there's an effort to ban assault weapons here in Florida. People that already have them would be allowed to keep them, but further sales of assault weapons in Florida would be banned. Under the Second Amendment, what do you think the founders would think about such a ban on assault weapons?
Well, of course, you know, whenever you start to say, what would the founders think, you know, most historians say, hey, it's above my pay grade, you know.
Okay. Well, what's your interpretation?
Well, I mean, I think that most of our public policy debates tend to be very emotional, and we should really be having a much calmer, more deliberative debate. And as a general rule, I'm not, you know, my preferred policy tools are not comprehensive bans, particularly comprehensive bans that really aren't comprehensive, as in the case of assault weapons, because you'd allow a lot of weapons to sneak through because of the way it's so hard to define assault weapons. At least in a way that would politically allow you to take them off the streets. And then you grandfather people in who already have them, and that sort of makes it very easy to sell them on the black market. So actually my preferred approach to these is actually to go back to the founders' model and to sort of use taxation and to both give incentives for responsible gun owners, like, you know, give people tax breaks for owning gun safes, for taking gun safety courses, you know, to tell people, look, if you want to learn how to use an AR-15, you know, you can own one, but you got to lock it up the way you lock up your golf clubs at the range. And, you know, if you do that, you know, we're not going to tax you. But if you want to have that gun at home and it's got to be locked up and maybe it needs to be inspected and maybe you need insurance and maybe we're going to tax you. Whereas, you know, we need to build in incentives for smart, responsible gun ownership. We basically, the way we do this is it's like either no guns or no gun laws, you know, or, you know, gun laws that are crafted, you know, and to make it possible to pass them, but not actually thinking through in a kind of comprehensive manner. Well, let's just think about the whole panoply of policy options, and let's design a coherent, effective means of making everyone safer and do it at not no cost to gun owners. You know, you never get any public policy that doesn't have any cost, but at a reasonable cost, because we're all paying for the cost of our current gun policies, as, you know, parents in Parkland know in a tragic way. So, you know, again, if you think about it, there are some countries in the world that have a lot of guns and that have sort of democratic cultures like Israel and Switzerland, but those are countries with very strong gun regulations. So they have both well-armed populations but tightly regulated populations when it comes to guns. That seems to me the only viable way forward. And that means we have to have sort of calm input from gun owners, and we have to have calm input from people concerned about gun safety and gun regulation. And of course, you know, that is not the way American politics seems to operate at the moment.
I hear some gun opponents say that they want to have the right to be safe from gunshots. And I also hear them say that guns have more rights than people. What do you think about those two concepts, that there should be a right to be safe from gunshots, or that right now we honor guns more than we honor people's lives?
Well, there's some truth to that, I think. I mean, actually, the research I've been doing most recently is about a whole side of the way the founders thought about guns that has completely been eclipsed, because, you know, a lot of the writing about guns has been done by partisans and people without very serious historical training. And one of the key concepts, both under English law and even under American law at the time that the Second Amendment was proposed, was the concept of the peace, and that you were entitled to enjoy the peace, and that actions which threatened the peace were regulated, and you could be prosecuted for actions that potentially threatened the peace. So, for instance, it seems ironic that we've gone to this sort of open carry and concealed carry set of policies, because the founders took a pretty dim view of expansive open carry.
Wait a minute, I thought everybody in cowboy times or in Revolutionary War times had a gun in their saddlebag and a rifle slung over their shoulder, and they used it. That everybody had it.
Well, I mean, that's sort of how, you know, Fess Parker's and Walt Disney's Adventures of Davy Crockett portray the American past. But most people didn't live on the frontier. And in most jurisdictions, although the Slave South is interesting because that's where you see the most expansive set of policies about allowing people to carry guns in public. In most places, you had to have a reasonable fear of imminent threat in order to justify being armed in public. I mean, obviously, you had your militia weapon in the home, and, you know, you could carry that weapon to muster. You could take it out and use it to kill critters on your property. You could use it in a lot of legitimate, lawful ways. But, you know, even in Dodge City, you had to check your guns at the edge of town. So even, you know, the Wild Wild West, actually, it turns out they've had pretty tight gun control.
You mean the movie's got it wrong?
Hard to believe, huh?
We're talking with Saul Cornell. He's a professor of history at Fordham University. He'll be speaking this Friday night at 8 p.m. at the University of Tampa at the Vaughn Center on the 9th floor. And he's the author of several books, including A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers, and The Origins of Gun Control in America. You just mentioned slavery for a moment. Tell us about the impact of slavery and gun ownership and gun control in the 1800s and the 1700s.
Well, of course, you know, as we see today with some of the headlines, the very complicated connections between guns and race in American history continues to haunt us. And there's no question that there's a tradition of disarming African Americans that's closely tied to the regime of slavery. It's also true there's a tradition that has nothing to do with that, that's all about neutral regulation of firearms to make everyone safer. So depending on the moment in American history that you're talking about, you can typically find two different kinds of gun laws. Some, particularly in the South, are motivated by racial animus, and the goal is to control the African-American population. And there are others that are sort of animated by a different impulse. The goal is to make everyone safer by making sure that gun owners are acting responsibly, and we're not seeing a proliferation of firearms in the public square.
Mm-hmm. Were gun ownership rights or gun rights much more loose in the South so that Southerners who were either going after escaped slaves or Southerners who owned slaves could better control the African American population?
Well, there's no question that now appears to be the case. That if you go to Heller, what's remarkable is all the great gun rights cases that Scalia cites, they all come from slave judges in the antebellum South. That there's this tradition that emerges there. And this is where the sort of modern gun rights ideology comes from. Now, there is a kind of ironic twist in it, in that in response to this sort of slave-owning gun rights ideology, you get a kind of very, almost a mirror image among some of the most radical abolitionists. This is where sort of your John Brown types come from, which is, they are almost as religious in their view of firearms as the radical gun rights people defending slavery. And so you get this really, this is the subject of my new book that I'm working on, about this way in which you get the most radical support for gun rights, both from abolitionists and from ardent defenders of slavery. It's really quite a remarkable story and hasn't been told, and hopefully when I finish this book, everyone will be able to read about it.
Well, I don't want to monopolize all your time. Let me just ask one more question, because we've gone way beyond the time that we originally talked about. Our guest is Saul Cornell, who's the Paul and Diane Gunther Chair in American History at Fordham University, and he'll be speaking this Friday night at the University of Tampa. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori. Let me just ask one more question. This brings it right up to today. After the Parkland massacre in South Florida, you wrote that parents who have guns at home should be required to tell their children's school. Why?
Well, for instance, I live one town over from Newtown, and so I understand what the consequences of a horrific mass shooting can do to a community. And I remember being in a town meeting where there's talk about resource officers. There was, all kinds of discussions about what we could do to make our schools safer. But the one thing that didn't come up was the simple reality: if somebody was going to perpetrate an Adam Lanza type school shooting in our town, he was likely going to get the gun from his family. And we have no idea. There's we talk about inoculating kids so we don't bring dangerous pathogens into our schools, but we ought to start thinking seriously about requiring parents to say, look, I'm a gun owner, but I'm a responsible gun owner. Those guns are locked up, and I can, tell you for sure that my kids will not have access to those firearms. But we don't do that, and that doesn't strike me as being good for anyone. I mean, let's face it, responsible gun owners do the right thing. But Adam Lanza's mother didn't, and clearly the woman in Parkland didn't either. And what becomes so much harder in modern America, and what was just taken for granted in the founders' generation, was that communities and families were able to maintain control over these arms in a way that is much harder in our more anonymous urban and market-driven society. So we need to find some way to restore those kinds of informal, neighborly, family checks on people so that we don't have Adam Lanzas emerging in all of our schools. I mean, parents need to really be responsible about how they handle firearms when there are children in the home, and it used to just be taken for granted. But maybe we need to start applying some penalties and enacting some laws to force people to do what common sense should dictate they do anyway.
So, have you ever proposed a list of reforms that might be consistent with the Second Amendment, but yet might produce more peace and less harm?
Well, I've been working on this issue a long time, and you know, I periodically have written several things. I did write something that was published. I'm trying to remember where it ended up in Slate or Salon about, you know, five types of gun laws the founding fathers loved. It's also up on something called The Conversation, which is a website that a lot of scholars contribute to. I mean, again, the reality is that if we honored the Second Amendment, we would have much more rigorous gun regulation than we do now, not less gun regulation. We would still be a very well-armed society, especially compared to Europe, because we've always been a very well-armed society. But what we seem to have forgotten is that regulation is not antithetical to liberty. It's the precondition for liberty, and that you know anarchy is just as much a threat to liberty as tyranny, and we certainly are very, very well aware of the danger posed by tyranny, but I don't think we're quite as well aware of the danger posed by anarchy. And you know, I think Parkland and Newtown, those are examples of anarchy, and that is not good for liberty.
Well, Saul Cornell, thank you so much. I think we all learned a lot, and thanks for spending all this time with us. And we'll see you Friday night, 8 o'clock, the University of Tampa in downtown Tampa, talking about the Second Amendment myths and realities. It begins at 8 p.m. at the Vaughn Center on the 9th floor. And for our listeners' sake, Saul is the author of several books, including A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers, and the Origins of Gun Control in America. Saul Cornell, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Thank you, Saul. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Saul is up in New England, and he's going to be flying down in the next few days to give that talk at UT. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Jeff Haynes is our phone producer today, and when I contacted Saul a few days ago, I said, Saul, I'll just have you on for 20 minutes. And I know he's a busy professor, so I didn't want to monopolize too much of his time. And I'm grateful for the time that he gave us. Let's take some phone calls, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Les in Brooksville says, great show. Saul is a great speaker. We already have a well-regulated militia. It's called the National Guard. Owners of assault weapons are not well-regulated. Consider most assault weapons owners are white males who own 10 or more, not fact-checked, he says. These men are primarily anarchists, not Minutemen, writes Les in Brooksville. All right, let's go to the phones, and let's go to Gary in Sefner. Gary, what would you like to say?
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for calling in.
Mike, thank you. That was very interesting. More than my brain is tired now. The only thing I would like to say is that I just feel that, you know, when it came to the Second Amendment, the whole idea was that the states defended themselves with a militia. And you couldn't have a King George tell the Americans that they can't have guns, and therefore the right to bear arms was a necessity. But I didn't think it ever gave these men, the average citizen, the right to have a cannon. So the regulation of the weaponry that you have, I mean, does matter. And of course, that's why we have a Supreme Court, to understand that as time goes by, things change, but it's to understand the balance of how things should be, and that's their role. And then the only other thing I would like to add, or at least because he covered so much, and it's just overwhelming, you know, when it comes to guns and gun regulation, to me, I believe, I don't understand why we don't have more tranquilizer guns proliferant all over the country, because I don't see why you have to kill everybody. You could tranquilize them, and then if they need to die, kill them. Sorry to say it like that.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. You know, Saul made the point, you know, to your first one, that the founders didn't really have an idea that we'd end up with, you know, semi-automatic weapons and shoulder-fired missile launchers and all that. But Saul made the point that the First Amendment has changed, too, that we delivered newspapers in a very old-fashioned, very, you know, primitive way back in 1776 or 1781, and now we've got CNN and the Internet. And so you know, you got to give the Constitution some wiggle room to come up with new things. But I think Saul's but Saul's point
about the reality still is that if you go back to those days, I don't think it was acceptable for Joe Schmo to roll into town with a cannon.
Yeah, well, I think Saul's point, and I look forward to his new book when he talks about essentially the right to live in peace. And if you were out there in Las Vegas a few months ago, or if you were in Parkland School in the Parkland School a few months ago, your right to live in peace was taken away. So I can't wait for his new book. We'll get him on and when his new book comes out. Here in St. Petersburg, the other day, a woman is sitting on her porch and she gets shot by a stray bullet. And there's no way to trace that bullet. You know, at least if we had a way to trace that bullet, we could find the perpetrator, but we don't even have a way to trace that bullet. So,
it shouldn't even be a bullet because, you know, let's face it, people are going to get angry and they're going to feel like they need to use extreme force. But people are not trained with weapons as much as you would like to think about it. There's only 1% of America that's in the military at any one time. So only 1, maybe 2, maybe 5% of them has real gun skill. After that, you're an amateur in my book. And to me, don't fire a real weapon if you don't know how to use it. Actually fire a tranquilizer gun and then do whatever you have to do. That woman, if she got hit by a tranquilizer gun, whoever shot her accidentally, well, you know you didn't kill this woman. But now you killed the woman, you know? And that's just unnecessary.
And I think the fact that people are shooting their guns in all directions on a street in St. Petersburg is the anarchy that Saul mentioned that our founders really didn't want. They didn't want that kind of anarchy going on. But Saul's not here to defend himself. And I'm pretty sure that's what he would say.
I agree with him. Yeah. Anarchy is just as dangerous to liberty as quote-unquote too much regulations towards gun control or whatever.
Yeah, finding that sweet spot.
Yeah, and this is one for the NRA people out there. You know, as far as I can tell, a lot of money came from the Russian oligarchs, and the people from the NRA don't want the government to know who they are and thus gun regulation. But my opinion is, if the NRA knows who you are, we know, or, you know, who has guns. You are on a list. Don't be so naive.
All right, Gary, thanks a lot. Thanks. Thanks for your comments. I'm going to move on to some other people, but thank you very much for your comments. Joe writes this. He's in Tampa. He says, that was a brilliant scholar you had on. Essentially, he said regulation on gun rights improves gun rights. That's a factually correct and antithetical concept. Love your show. I'm going to see him speak with as many people as I can muster on Friday night. So, Joe, thanks for your email. You can send your email into the studio here. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. You are listening to WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for tuning in. Let's go to Tony in Oldsmar. Hi, Tony. Tony, take it away.
Yeah, Justice Scalia, in his last book, While He Was Still Alive, in the first chapter or introduction, what he says is, okay, I'm going to tell you how to interpret laws, or you should be interpreting laws, but then he says, I don't always do what I say.
I don't always do what I say, okay.
It's in there. You can read the
All right.
Now, the second part is, as I understand from a historian, I don't remember the name, relatively recently, the amendment, which became two, that Madison submitted had individual gun rights in it in some form. When it went through the process, the committee, whatever, they took all that out.
That Madison took it out, or
No. He had put it in the amendment as he wrote it. as I understand it, was the right of individuals to carry guns was included. Now, in the process of going through the committee, it was taken out.
Well, that's a question I should have asked Saul Cornell.
If you're an originalist, that's what you put. I mean, that's truly the original. The people who decided took it out.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And Tony, where can I look that up? Where are you getting this from?
I can't remember now. This was about 2 months ago.
All right. Well, I'm sure we can look up the history of the Second Amendment and find that in a good history book. Tony, you're breaking up, so I'm going to move on.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. We got a bad connection. Not sure what's going on. Diane is in Tampa. Diane, thanks for calling in. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I really agreed with a lot of what Saul said, and I really liked a lot of things he said until he said the thing about mothers being responsible for educating young men on the use of guns. I just feel like that's so typical of a dude to put the responsibility on women, especially when you look at the rate of mass shootings in this country and who those perpetrators are, like how many of them are women. It's such a minuscule percentage. And what we really need to look at is instead, yes, the responsibility is going to fall on women like it usually does with these things, but it's just unfair to put it on women when it really falls on the toxic masculinity in this country, and that's really the issue.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, though, in the case of Newtown, the shooter was living with his mom, and I think that may be why Saul brought it up. But I think, to your general point, we all, as parents, we all got to take that responsibility. It shouldn't
right.
be hung on women. I know what you're saying about toxic masculinity, because I think it's the fallback position that a lot of guys have, that we assume certain things that we should not assume. So I'm glad you raised the point.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Diane. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Please call that number if you want to get on the show. Jackie writes this, love the idea of more responsible gun ownership with requirements for insurance and gun safes. I think many others would like this too, but I can predict the pushback argument with the hunters nearby saying, this creates guns only for the rich who can afford these things. And yes, some hunters use assault rifles. That's a Jackie in upstate New York. Yeah, you know, I used to live in western Pennsylvania, and this time of year around deer hunting season, there would be so many accidents out there. So many people would go out willy-nilly searching for guns in rural Pennsylvania. Jackie's point that it creates guns only for the rich who could afford these things, yeah, the question of how much the insurance would be is a big issue. How much would insurance end up being for an assault rifle? How much would insurance end up being for a .22 rifle that you just use for target practice? I think clearly insurance for assault rifles would be a lot, but given all the accidents, given all the mass shootings, is that something that we want in society? Should there be a requirement that if you're going to buy a weapon which is really designed to kill, like an AR-15, it's designed to kill humans, it's really not designed for hunting. Should the ability to have that weapon coincide with the responsibility for having insurance so that the cost isn't borne out by society? Certainly, society is bearing a lot of the cost of the mass shooting in Parkland. Society is bearing a lot of the cost of the shooting in Las Vegas, all the other mass shootings. So is that fair? You know, just because you want to have the right to have a gun, and maybe one out of a million people go over the edge and then kill 78 people, should there be a requirement just in case that that gun is not used to injure or curtail the rights of the victims? Let's go to Corinne in St. Petersburg. Hi, Corinne. You're on WMNF.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, great, great. Listen, I have a friend in Western New York who's a Native American, and they go out shooting every year, and they teach their kids, you know, total responsibility, but it's for food. And that's where I think we've lost the whole idea, rather than protection, you know, that are you going to use these assault weapons to shoot for food? No, because you know the fragments go all over the bodies, you know, like they do with the individuals when they get shot. You know, the fragments go everywhere in the bodies.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, you can't really use them to shoot food.
Yeah. So, what do your friends? Yeah. What do your friends teach their kids about gun safety?
Everything. You bet. Everything is locked up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, they don't even touch them unless it's hunting season. And he's thinking about teaching his grandchildren how to use a bow and arrow.
Well, now,
so anyway, it was just another thought. It was, you know, crazy. But I love you guys.
All right. Thanks, Corinne. Thank you. Good to hear from you. And
yeah, always good to hear from you. I do want to challenge you with one thing.
All right.
Our governor is so concerned about his politics that he has totally ignored the people in the panhandle. And I think we should do a session on that, because these people are hungry, they're cold, they're living in tent cities. And it's just a deplorable situation.
And Corinne, that's a really good point. And yesterday afternoon, Sean Canaan in our newsroom had two long interviews with a woman who's living in a tent just outside of Panama City. And Sean, I think, is the only radio reporter here in the Tampa Bay area that reported that. I played some of that sound this morning at 8:30, too. I hope you tuned in at 8:30.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there is an ongoing problem in the panhandle, and I noticed the governor's schedule today. He's got nothing on his schedule, but there are hundreds of people living in tents in the cold right outside of Panama City. They've been thrown out of their houses by the landlords. There's not enough housing, obviously, up there in the wake of the hurricane, and there's a problem, and I got to say, there's a story on the front page of the Times about the hurricane, but it ignores this issue of homelessness, and I think it's a big issue, and I got to give credit to Sean in our news department for bringing it out.
I have a friend who's a long haul trucker, and he went through Panama, you know, that whole area, and he said he's been in tornadoes, he's been in hurricanes, he says he's never seen that kind of destruction anywhere in the United States.
Yeah, it's horrible. We got to pay attention to it. And the governor is taking a day off today, and he shouldn't take a day off today. So,
no,
Corinne, thanks a lot. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for being there.
Yeah, there is a big problem up there. And you can listen to Sean's story on our website. Just go to WMNF.org, and you can hear his entire interview with the woman who's she and her kids are living in a tent in this cold weather because of the hurricane. Let's go to Davey in Clearwater. Is it Davey or Darby?
Darby,
how are you?
Good, and you?
I'm great. What's up?
I agree the gun violence is horrific, and the thing that the millionaire did in Las Vegas made me wonder if you think this is even in the realm of possibility. I know, for example, a doctor, and he's got a 20,000 square foot warehouse, and it's full of old tanks and half-tracks and things like that. And I know that they're disabled, but I'm wondering if you think it's within the realm of possibility that any of these groups that are anarchists would get a piece of equipment like that and retrofit it and try it and start something.
Well, I think retrofitting a tank is pretty hard to do because you need the right parts. I mean, you might have some really skilled welders and, you know, tool and die makers, but I kind of doubt that you could take a tank and rearm it, especially if it was in heavy use the first time. But your point being, you're worried about anarchists.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think that anarchists you think that they pose a general threat to the peacefulness of society, or?
Yes, and I don't think that there's enough awareness on the part of law enforcement about many of these groups there are.
So is it anarchists or is it far right groups? Because, you know, the groups that I see that present the most danger are the Proud Boys, the neo-Nazis, you know, groups that actually arm themselves, preach hate, and then try to provoke people in places like Charlottesville, surround churches and scream at the people inside. I mean, it's the far right groups that present the most danger. The anarchists, at least, you know, in places like Portland or San Francisco, where there's been confrontations between the far right and the anarchists are really trying to stand up against fascism, aren't they? They're the ones saying, look, you clowns who are Nazis, who are trying to revive this Nazi movement in America, is basically an un-American movement, get out of here. I mean, aren't they the heroes in places like Portland?
I don't know. I thought they both wanted to have race wars.
No, I don't think the anarchists want to have a race war. I think the anarchists want to say to the neo-Nazis who come barreling into a place like Portland, the anarchists are saying, get out. Portland is a liberal city. We don't want your kind here, and don't try to start. I mean, the Nazis want the race war. The neo-Nazis for 70 years have wanted to start a race war in the U.S. So the anarchists are just there defending people against these neo-fascists.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Darby, thanks a lot. Well, on that note, we're going to end the show. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up on our comment line. It's 813-238-8001. You can comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comment back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. And stay tuned. NOLA's coming up on the Midpoint program. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for listening. And now we're going to get the latest news from NPR.